The engineer unrolled the plans he carried, spread them on the dusty earth at his feet, and anchored the corners with diamondiferous pebbles from Zuga's trailing dump, which had spilled into and was threatening to engulf the entire camp. "I have considered a cantilever design," Hayes began to explain the drawings in crisp technical terms, and the others moved their seats closer and bowed over the plans. "We'll have to use hand winches and perhaps horse whims until we can get a steam engine to do the haulage." They discussed it quietly, asking penetrating questions, and when the answers were obscure, cutting down for them with sharp minds and quick words. There was no waste of words, no repetitions, no drawn-out discussion, and the work went swiftly. The stagings would be tall scaffoldings built on the edge of the pit, and they would house the haulage winches. "We'll have to use steel houses. Manila will never do the job," Hayes told them. "There'll have to be a single wire to each individual claim. A lot of wire."
"How long to get it out?"
2 months to Cape Town."
"How much is this going to cost?" Zuga asked the question, which had been burning his lips all morning.
"More than any of us can afford," smiled Pickering. A man with 1,000 guineas in his pocket was a rich man on New Rush in these days.
"What we cannot afford is not to do it," Rhodes answered, without a smile.
"What about those diggers who cannot afford their share of the stagings?" Zuga persisted, and Rhodes shrugged.
"Either they find the money or they will not have a wire down to their claims. From now on, it's going to take capital to work a claim on the New Rush."
"Those who haven't got it will have to sell out. It's as easy as that." "Well, since the cave-in, the price of claims in the number 6 has dropped to £100, Zuga said. "Anybody who sells now is going to take a hell of a knock."
"And anybody who buys at £100 is going to make a killing," Rhodes answered him, and lifted his pale blue eyes from Hayes's plans,
and for a moment held Zuga's gaze significantly. He was giving advice, Zuga realized. But what impressed Zuga was the strength and determination behind that level gaze. He no longer wondered why somebody so young commanded such widespread respect on the diggings.
"Are we all agreed, then?" he asked.
With less than £20 cash in the world, and his claims cut off 80 feet below ground level and partially covered by the earth fall of the roadway, Zuga hesitated.
"Major Ballantyne?"
They were all looking at him.
"Are you in?"
"Yes," he nodded firmly.
"Count me in."
He would find the money, somewhere, somehow. They all relaxed, and Pickering chuckled. "It's never easy to play it all on one card." He understood.
"Pickling, didn't I hear your saddlebag clink when you dismounted?" Rhodes asked.
And Pickering laughed again and went to fetch the bottle.
"Cordon argent,"
he said as he pulled the cork. "The right juice for such an occasion, gentlemen." They swished the coffee grounds from their mugs and held them out for a dram of the cognac.
"The number 6 stagings, fast may they rise and long may they stand,"
Pickering gave them the toast, and they drank together. Hayes wiped his whiskers with the back of his hand and stood up.
"I'll have the quantities ready to send off on the noon coach tomorrow," he said, and hurried to his mount.
Men who worked for Rhodes were always in a hurry, but neither Pickering or Rhodes moved to follow him. Instead, Rhodes stretched out his long legs in the stained white cricket flannels and crossed his dusty riding boots at the ankles, at the same time offering his coffee mug to Pickering.
"I'll be damned if we don't have something else to celebrate this day," he said as Pickering glugged cognac into their mugs.
"The Imperial Factor," Pickering suggested.
"The Imperial Factor," Rhodes agreed.
And when he smiled, the cleft in his smooth chin deepened, and the melancholy line of his full lips under the fair moustache relaxed.
"Even this awful creature Gladstone has not been able to halt the march of empire northwards through Africa. The Foreign Office has moved at last. The Griquas are to be recognised as British subjects, and Waterboer's request has been granted. Griqualand West is to become part of the Cape Colony and of the Empire. We have Lord Kimberley's assurance on it."
"That's wonderful news," Zuga interrupted.
"You think so?"
The pale blue eyes sought and held Zuga's.
"I know it to be so," Zuga told him.
There is only one way to bring peace and civilization to Africa, and that is under the Union Jack.
Immediately there was a relaxation of the relationship between the three men, an unspoken accord, so that even without moving, they seemed to have drawn closer, and their task was easier, more intimate. "We are the first nation in the world, and anything less than our total duty is unworthy of us," Zuga went on, and Rhodes nodded. "We destroyed the slave trade on this continent. That was only a beginning. When you have seen the conditions that still exist, the savagery and barbarism to the north of us, only then can you appreciate how deep that duty still is."
"Tell me about the hinterland," Rhodes demanded in that thin, almost querulous voice that so ill-suited his big, loose-knit frame.
"The hinterland." It was an unusual term, but it stuck like a burr, and Zuga heard himself use it as he described that wilderness through which he had travelled and hunted and prospected. Rhodes sat on a log of firewood, the shaggy leonine head sunk forward, brooding and silent, only his eyes quick and attentive, listening with an almost religious fervour, rousing himself every few minutes, lifting his head to ask a question, and then letting it sink again to the answer. Zuga spoke of the wide, slow rivers that ran in their deep valleys, where the cream of Tatar trees grew upon the banks, and in the green shallows herds of hippopotamus challenged the traveller with gaping pink mouths and curved white tusks. He described the deadly malarial swamps, vast stands of papyrus reeds swaying like dancers from horizon to horizon, where the sky pressed down, smothering the world under a heavy blue blanket, sodden with steamy vapours. And he told of the relief of climbing the steep rocky escarpments to the cool high plateau of golden grasslands. With words he showed them the vast and empty spaces, the plains dotted with moving herds of wild game, the cool green forests of standing timber, the streams of sweet water, crystal cold, from which a man could water his herds or his homestead. He talked of vanished kingdoms, of long-dead kings, the Mambo and the Monomotapa, who had built cities of massive grey stone and left them to the smothering vines, their idols thrown down and shattered, the foundations of the walls menaced by the twisted grey python roots of the wild fig trees, which found the joints in the stonework and forced them inexorably apart. He told them of the square mineshafts that these vanished people had driven into the matrix and then abandoned, leaving the gold-bearing quartz where they had piled it before they fled. "Visible gold," he told them, "thick as butter in the reef, lying out there in the bush." He spoke of the people, the remnants of the subjects of the Monomotapa, their glories long past decimated by war. He told them of the conquerors, the Matabele, the cruel legions from the south, calling the subservient tribes cattle and contemptuously Mashona, eaters of dirt, taking them as slaves, killing them as sport to prove their manhood, or merely on the king's whim. He described the wealth of the Matabele, their uncountable herds of cattle, thousands upon tens of thousands of fine beasts, glossy humpback bulls whose bloodlines ran back to Egypt and the land between the Tigris and the Euphrates. Big, rangy animals with widespread horns and hides of every colour, from unrelieved black to purest white. He told them of deep and secret caverns in the hills, where the priests of the vanished kings still conducted their mysteries and sustained the oracle, weaving a gossamer net of witchcraft and magic which enfolded even their proud and arrogant Matabele overlords. Then, as the day wasted away and the sun began to set behind a flaming curtain of red dust, Zuga told them of the kraals of the Matabele, the impis trained into the most merciless killing machine Africa had ever brought forth, racing barefoot into battle behind their tall rawhide shields, the plumes nodding and streaming from their dark heads, and the dazzle of their assegais lighting the plains as the stars light the night sky.
"How would you fight them, Ballantyne?"
Rhodes fired the question harshly, and it checked Zuga in full lyrical flow. They stared at each other for a moment, but a moment that was fraught with portent, a moment in which the lives of many thousands, black men and white, teetered in the balance. Then slowly, the arm of the balance came down on one side, and the destiny of a continent moved. like a fiery planet shifting its orbit through the universe.
I would thrust for the heart, Zuga said, suddenly his eyes cold and green. A small mobile force of mounted men? How many men?
And suddenly they were talking war, as the sun fell below the dusty mauve and purple plain, leaving the sinister shadows to draw in around the little group under the camel thorn tree.
Yan Shirut threw logs on the fire, and they sat on in the ruddy wavering light, and the talk was of gold and of war, diamonds and gold and war, empire and war. And their words conjured columns of armed and mounted men from the night, dark phantoms riding into the future.
Suddenly Zuga checked in the middle of a sentence. His expression changed as though he had seen a ghost or recognized an old implacable enemy in the shadows under the camel-thorn tree.
"What is it, Ballantyne?"
Rhodes asked sharply, swiveling the big, untidy head to follow the direction of Zuga's gaze. Against the bole of the thorn tree stood the tall, green soapstone bird statue. Unnoticed until now, hidden by the welter of harness and loose equipment that festooned the branches around it, some trick of the flames, the fall and flare of one of the burning logs, had illuminated it with sudden and dramatic firelight. It stood taller than the seated men, seeming to preside over their councils, listening to and directing the talk of gold and of blood. The falcon head, timeless as evil itself, as ancient as the hills of the far land from which it had been hewn, stared back at Zuga with sightless, yet somehow all-seeing blank eyes. The cruel curve of the beak seemed on the point of opening to emit the falcon's hunting cry, or to bury itself in living flesh. To Zuga, it seemed that in the darkness above the statue, the words of the prophecy, spoken so long ago in that deep cavern of the Matopus Hills, by the beautiful naked witch who was the Amlimo of Monomotapa, still persisted, hovering in the shadows like living things.
"The stone falcons will fly far. There shall be no peace in the kingdoms of the Mambos or the Monomotapas until they return. For the white eagle will war with the black bull until the stone falcons return to roost."
In his memory, Zuga heard the words again, spoken by that silken voice, and they seemed to echo against the dome of his skull and fill the drums of his ears.
"What is it, my dear fellow?"
Pickering repeated the question, and something slithered along Zuga's spine and crawled upon the skin of his forearms, so that the hair came erect, and he had to shudder to free himself of it.
Nothing, he answered huskily. It's nothing. A grey goose walked over my grave.
But he stared still at the statue, and Rhodes followed his gaze.
"By Jove, isn't that the bird you wrote about in the book?"
Rhodes sprang to his feet. Eagerly he strode to where it stood, and paused before it for a long, silent moment, before he reached out and touched the head.
"What an extraordinary piece of work,"
he said softly, and went down on one knee to examine the shark-tooth pattern that was carved into the plinth. In that attitude he seemed like a worshipper, a priest conducting some weird rite before the idol. Again, Zuga felt that superstitious flutter of nerves crawl like insects upon his skin, and to break the mood he called loudly for Yan Shirut to bring a lantern. In the lantern's beam they scrutinized the polished greenish stone, and as Rhodes ran his big, large, knuckled hand over it, his expression was rapt. The gaze of those strange, pale eyes remote, like a poet hearing words in his head. Long after Pickering and Zuga had returned to their seats by the log fire, Rhodes stood alone under the camel-thorn tree with the falcon, and when at last he left it to join them once more, his tone was brittle with accusation.
"That thing is a treasure, Ballantyne. It's unforgivable to leave it lying out under a tree."
"It's lain in worse conditions for hundreds, perhaps thousands of years," Zuga replied dryly.
"You were right,"
Rhodes sighed, his attention straying back to the bird.
"It's yours to do with as you wish."
And then impulsively,
I wish to purchase it from you. Name a price.
It's not for sale, Zuga told him.
£500, said Rhodes.
The sum startled Zuga, but his reply was immediate.
No. £1,000.
I say, Pickering intervened.
You can pick up 10 claims in number 6 section for that.
Rhodes did not glance at him, but he nodded.
Yes, you could. Or Major Ballantyne could pay for his share of the new stagings with £1,000.
£1,000. Zuga felt himself tempted. £1,000 would stand himself clear.
No, he shook his head. I'm sorry.
He felt he had to explain.
It has become the household god, my personal good luck symbol.
Good luck? Snorted Jan Schurut from across the fire. And all three of them turned their heads in his direction. None of them noticed him sitting on the edge of the shadows like a wizened little yellow gnome.
Good luck, the Hottentot repeated scornfully. Since we picked up that for damned bird, we haven't seen a day's good luck.
He spat into the fire, and his phlegm sizzled and exploded in a little puff of steam.
That bird has put blisters on our feet and rubbed the skin from our backs. It has broken the axles of our wagons and lamed our horses. It has brought us fever and sickness and death. Miss Aletta died looking at that bird, and Geordie would have followed her if I hadn't thrown the fordump thing out.
That's nonsense, Zuga snapped sharply.
That's an old Hottentot maid superstition.
Jar!
Jan Schurut challenged him hotly.
Is it an old Hottentot superstition that we are sitting in the dust of this hellhole, swatting flies and rubbing empty bellies? Is it superstition that all around us they are pulling fat diamonds and we find only the droppings and manure? Is it superstition that the earth has fallen on our claims and that it nearly swallowed Ralph? Is that your good luck that you boast the bird brings you, Master Zuga? If it is, then hear the words of old Jan Schurut and take the £1,000 that Mr. Rhodes offers you. Take it with both hands and thank him for getting rid of that thing.
Jan Schurut ran out of words and glared across the fire at the bird shape under the thorn trees.
Damn me, Pickering smiled. But you nag like a wife.
None of them were surprised at the familiar address between servant and master. In Africa, relationships like this were common. The servant considering himself to be part of the family, with a voice in the affairs of the family, and his claim was accepted by all.
Jan Schurut has hated the idol since the day we discovered it. Tell me about that day, Jan Schurut,
ordered Rhodes briskly. And Jan Schurut puffed up visibly with self-importance. There were few things he enjoyed more than an important and attentive audience and a good story to tell. While he made a show of packing his clay pipe with black Machalisbech shag tobacco and lighting it with an ember from the fire, the two boys crept out of the tent, drawn by the prospect of a story. They glanced cautiously at Zuga, and when he made no move to send them back, they were emboldened. Geordie sat next to Jan Schurut and leaned his curly golden head against the Hottentot's shoulder, while Ralph came diffidently to sit with the men beside the fire.
We had been 1 year in the bush, Jan Schurut began. 1 year without seeing a civilized man, 1 year trekking and hunting.
And the boys settled down with delicious anticipation. They had heard the story 100 times before, and enjoyed each telling more than the last.
We had killed 200 great elephants since leaving the Zambezi River, and we had fought bad men and savages. Our porters and mostly deserted or died of disease, and wild animals. Our provisions were long finished, no salt, no tea, no medicine, and little gunpowder. Our clothes were rags, our boots worn through and repaired with the wet hide of buffalo. It had been a killing journey, over mountains with no passes, and rivers with no names, and ordinary men would long ago have fallen, and the birds would have picked their bones white. Even we were tired and sick, and we were lost. Around us, as far as our eyes could see, there was nothing but wild hills and bad bush, through which only the buffalo could pass.
And you needed honey for your strength, Geordie burst out, unable to contain himself, and knowing the story, word perfect. Otherwise you would have died in the bush.
And we needed honey for our strength, or we would have died in the bush,
Yanisharut agreed solemnly.